You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 67. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey. Today, my guest, a little different, not directly related to Bitcoin, but a little tangential and related in the sense of equalizing things, and is Austin Jones. He is chief engineer and head of Atlas Arms. Austin, welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So, Austin, you and I met at Bear Arms and Bitcoin. Well, that was when we officially met in person. We'd kind of interacted online. But can you tell my listeners who may or may not be familiar with your work a little bit about Atlas Arms and the project that you're working on?
Yeah. First, I think the first time we interacted, you were helping us set up with a Samurai wallet, or at least with Paynims, which is great. So thank you for that.
Absolutely.
Atlas Arms. Well, if I might say, we try to be, and I think we are, something of a DARPA for DIY or DIY firearms, or maybe just, I don't know, firearms intended for individual citizens. Our big project right now, even though we have a few smaller ones, is the Dagny Dagger. It is it is an armor penetrating cartridge, I suppose you would say. It can we're working first on a 9mm bullet that can easily penetrate armor, but I guess sidesteps the federal definition of armor piercing ammunition. Excuse me for tripping over my words. It's been kind of a long day. This is the first podcast I'm recording after we just dropped this video, so I've had a long day. That's really what it is, and we've dropped that video now showing that it does work. Works currently defeating 3A armor, which is general, you know, like soft or Kevlar body armor rated to stop almost all pistol bullets. And I suppose that's it. Is there any other aspect you'd like to know about it or that I didn't hit on?
No, I think that's kind of it. So what motivated you to take on this project?
So normally I say equality under the law. That's kind of the thing when the New York Times called me up, or like, you know, Ammoland, or, you know, the general crowd of media, I say equality under the law, that it's unethical that armor-piercing ammunition is denied to the citizens of this country when it is reserved for use by that nation's government. I find this to be quite unacceptable. I don't believe in prescriptive property prohibition in general, but especially when members of a particular caste in a society, like soldiers or police, are granted access to something that the commons in general are not. But maybe for selfish reasons, because I've always wanted to get into this a little bit, I would tell your listeners that are kind of are interested in Bitcoin, or maybe come from a more philosophically interested place, that I would like to, quote unquote, preserve the wilderness. This idea of just like the inhuman effect of our neoliberal society to like cage people and remove entire categories of, you know, things that can exist or actions that you can take, things that you can own. I want to break the fences, and, you know, we can talk about that some more if you want, or just get into other stuff.
No, let's talk about that, because that kind of goes with the I think it was the Cypherpunk Manifesto, you know, where he talked about these the barbed wire fences and you know, our modern day versions of wire cutters. So that's a very similar ethos to what you're talking about.
Yeah, it really is. And it's funny that they used that kind of language, because that's kind of how I was thinking about it even before I kind of connected with the, I don't know, the cyber community, the, you know, crypto community. But I don't know, I've always kind of felt this. And I guess the wilderness for me is a very abstract concept. And I mean, it goes anything from, like, I believe very much in preservation of, or like conservation of, you know, like ecological wilderness. I hate to see urban sprawl. I don't want to see cultivation cutting into, you know, natural pristine wilderness, and that kind of thing. And like, you know, that's not me saying, you know, like, oh, I'm down with the national parks and all that. To me, no, it goes beyond that. To me, you lose the wilderness even in the national parks when, like, the federal government controls it, when it's controlled by the Bureau of Land Management or the Forest Service or something like that. And then, of course, you know, like I grew up in Oklahoma. I would love to see the buffalo roaming again. And even in places that we call the wilderness, they're still fenced in. They're still surrounded by barbed wire. They still have, like, you know, 20 miles in which they can roam. They can't migrate the way they used to all over the continent. And I think that extends into, but like, that's what the wilderness is for ecology, for animals. But for humans, the wilderness is something else. For humans, the wilderness is, I don't know, like this vast sea of potential, generally speaking, this vast sea of, like, almost chaos, things beyond your control, from which you work to harvest meaning and, I don't know, resources for yourself, in which you kind of carve out a space to live in. I don't mean to wane like Jordan Peterson here or whatever. I guess it kind of sounds a little bit like it. But that's what it is for me. And so, you know, it really unnerves me watching, you know, whole regimes of human activity and creativity get captured by the state regulatory apparatus. And I kind of just buck against that. And I think that's what the Dagny Dagger is. Yeah.
So, are you familiar with the American Prairie Reserve Project?
I am not.
Okay. I will send you a link to this, to an episode of Econ Talk, and I'll put it in the show notes where they talk about, but basically it's, I want to say it's a section of land that borders, part of it I think is in Wyoming and maybe, Idaho or something like that. Mm-hmm. I have to be honest, like that area of the country, I'm not good on my geography. I mean, I could probably, you know, process of elimination, figure it out on a map, but I'm not great at it. But basically it's kind of this mix of, big sections of, open public land and various like private properties and ranches where they're trying to bring back like kind of this, not cultivated like national parks kind of thing. That's and just great. Like let it kind of grow wild and have big herds of wild animals. And I think you'd really like it because it, like I said, I'll send you that Econ Talk episode, but he goes into using, you know, a mixture of fundraising, of charity, of using these like the bison meat and stuff to raise funds for preserving the project and furthering the project and stuff like that. So
that's great. I appreciate you telling me about that. That's definitely right up my alley.
Yeah. And he goes into in the episode, he goes into kind of, you touched on it, but kind of some of the problems or the, fakeness that goes on in the national parks that I was unaware of like, you know, they didn't want people seeing wolves. So they like you know, tried to control the wolf population, which then caused other problems, overpopulation of some of the prey animals, or they talked about other times when people tried to create these things and they totally missed out on the whole idea of like brush fires being a part of the nature and part of the process of growing all of these things.
I gotta say, like, you know, last night as we all watched that, like, I don't know what to call it, train wreck of a debate, and that's putting it mildly. You know, Trump's talking about like, oh, you got to manage the forests, but like, kind of on that level, like you're talking about, like, what you don't manage forests, you don't manage the wilderness. It ceases to be the wilderness if you manage it. So you know, I believe that like humans can be a part of that. I feel like that. And, you know, even to kind of like expand on that, just cause I thought about it, you know, I used to work in the quote unquote private space industry. But honestly, I found it extremely disillusioning because everything is still controlled by the state, by the government. There is no private space industry really. It's just all contractors for NASA. So like even, you know, this idea of the wilderness and how, you know, humans can, it's like the nature of humanity to carve out a living from the natural wilds. Even the final frontier is already kind of taken over and ruined by state regulation. And of course, like me founding Atlas Arms comes after that experience. I'm very, very much driven to just open the realm of human possibility and creativity after the state shuts it down.
Yeah. So can you talk for a sec about how your work in the quote unquote private space sector affected, you know, that knowledge base, I guess, that you use for Atlas?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So like technically speaking, I worked for a company called Bigelow Aerospace. And the way that company was founded is an extremely crazy, eccentric billionaire, should look into him sometime, Robert Bigelow, bought the intellectual property, so they say, of NASA, which was for, I guess you could call it, inflatable spacecraft. Now, the idea of this is that you can only fit a certain size of capsule or vehicle into the fairing of a rocket to launch it into orbit. So, like, for instance, the International Space Station is built of all these different capsules and modules just connected together. Well, the idea is with an inflatable capsule, it fits in the rocket just barely, and then after it attaches to the space station or, you know, otherwise deploys, it can inflate and it becomes about three times larger than it was while it was packed into the rocket. So you have a living space or quarters or, you know, a spacecraft up there that's three times larger and more spacious than it could have been. Well, floating around in space, 6 to 12 kilometers per second is a whole lot of orbital debris and micrometeoroids, things that are moving so fast that when they collide into a solid object, they will instantly transform into a plasma. And this has to be shielded, of course. This, like, one of these things the size of a grain of rice can, you know, be the downfall of an entire space station. So what I was working on, my part of the project, was the design and implementation of that micrometeoroid shielding. So you can see then, because it's an inflatable spacecraft, the shielding had to be very soft. It was textile-based. And you can see then how that experience would translate into a lot of the knowledge and intuition that has become relevant to the Dagger.
Yeah, so you were essentially designing soft body armor for inflatable space station sections, and now you're kind of on the flip side of how to, you're working to penetrate it.
Yeah, isn't that funny? I'm a turncoat, I guess.
So what is, like, how are you kind of mentioned earlier sidestepping the current legal framework. For those who aren't familiar, what is the current legal framework for regarding armored piercing ammunition, and then what's kind of your general approach to sidestepping that?
Yeah, maybe some background. The Reagan administration was not very friendly to firearms freedom. Of course.
Wait, I thought Reagan was like the best Republican ever.
Well, they might tell you that, and maybe he was. But if he was, Republicans aren't too kind to gun control. And similar to how more gun control has happened under Trump than Obama, the Reagan administration was kind of similar. The Reagan administration saw to the end of our access to machine guns. And also saw to the end of our access to armor-piercing ammunition under what was called the Law Enforcement Officers Protection Act of 1985, went into effect in 1986. And it defined as armor-piercing ammunition any projectile or projectile core which may be used in a handgun that is composed entirely of, brass, bronze, beryllium, copper, steel, iron, tungsten alloys, or depleted uranium. I think that's the complete list. Or one whose jacket is a quarter of the total weight of the projectile. So, of course, that's a compositional definition, not a functional one. And, you know, that's important because functional definitions are, they're arbitrary by nature. So, of course, they had to say, like, okay, that they had to put, like, very, like, physical, objective criteria on it. But as we all kind of laugh at the governments or legislators' terrible understanding of the guns they try to regulate, that's not a complete picture. And creative thinking people, engineers, creators, like I am, like the other people are who comprise Atlas Arms, we know that there's other ways to do it. There are other ways to penetrate armor, and that's what we've done. We are using an alloy that is not on the list. It is quite an exotic alloy, one that they've probably, I'm sure, never heard of in their lives. So that's it.
Very cool. And then what about, there's something to the geometry as well, correct?
So part of the definition is that it can't have a jacket that's, you know, more than a quarter of the total weight. We don't fall under that either. We do have to kind of watch the geometry and the physical construction of the bullet a little bit for that. But it's not nearly as large of a barrier as the other criterion.
Cool. And so why is it that you said that the law was in 85, went into effect in 86? You know, why is it that... I mean, has it ever been updated, or it's the exact same definition as the one from 85?
Same as it always is. I guess now is a good time to say that there are a lot of states that have their own definition of armor piercing. It's not that many. I should say because of that, even the Dagny Dagger will be illegal in a few states. Some of them are really easy, like... I think New York, California, of course. And then there's something we wouldn't have thought about, like, of course, Texas.
Yes, you often like to rag on me because I'm very proud of Texas. But I have to admit, sorry, I'm whacking my table here. Oklahoma may actually have better gun laws than Texas.
Definitely does. Now, I'm an Oklahoman, and Texas will always be a sibling to me, I feel.
Yeah.
And I do feel a kinship to people in Texas. But Texas also loves their law enforcement officers. And of course, all of this armor-piercing ban was sold in the 80s as, you know, protecting policemen, as establishing protective police privilege. So in Texas, anything that is intended to penetrate armor is called armor-piercing ammunition. So not even the dagger will be legal there. I think it's worth noting that that is quite a dubious definition. And if a serious gun rights organization like the Second Amendment Foundation, the Firearms Policy Coalition, the Gun Owners of America, of course, these didn't, you know, the NRA was the only game in town in the 80s. If they were really involved with it and they spent the money, I'm sure it would be thrown out because it is entirely arbitrary and capricious. You can't enforce laws based on intentionality.
Right. You can't prove intention. So.
Well, right. Yeah. That's more the case. Yes.
Okay. So, let's see what, let's talk for a second about kind of what's, and this is part of what you talked about at Bear Arms and Bitcoin, kind of what's wrong with the gun industry. And I know that, like, if there's some of my listeners out there who don't care about gun stuff, sorry, like you're probably not going to like the rest of this episode, but, you know, I think Julia said it well at the conference. Like, I don't understand people who care about Bitcoin, who, at least if you care about its censorship resistant nature and its anti-authoritarian nature, if you don't also at least, like, you don't have to be super passionate about guns, but to be opposed to them seems contrary there. So sorry, folks, like, we're going to talk about gun stuff here. So it's my podcast and you're just gonna have to deal with it. But let's talk a little bit about what's wrong with the gun industry.
I mean, I could just give my, like, entire BAB talk, but
sure.
I'm not trained from that.
Okay.
So, like, I did, though, start that talk with something I guess I'll repeat. There is the Dagny Dagger, and part of its, you know, superiority in defeating armor is that it's very lightweight. And with that lightweight, you get an increased velocity that really helps defeat armor. It weighs 50 grains, which is very, very lightweight for 9mm. The projectile weighs that much. There is, though, another load called Liberty Civil Defense that also weighs 50 grains. And it is said to penetrate body armor also, but it doesn't do so reliably. If you're looking to be able to penetrate armor, you still want to stay away from it. It only works in perfect circumstances against a kind of lower tier armor. But it also, you know, since it's 50 grains, it's often, we're often compared to civil defense by others. And then also we kind of use it as we've developed our own ammunition as a sort of reference. So in that scope, we want, you know, in trying to figure out the powder load for our ammunition, we reverse engineered the powder load in civil defense, and we found out that it was 9.1 grains of Winchester Auto Comp. We also called up Hodgdon Powders, got in touch with their head ballistician, and he recommended that we start experimenting with the powder load at 9.1 grains of Winchester Auto Comp. Now, you could say, like, this guy's an expert, he knows exactly the powder load to use for 50 grains, but once you learn some more, that becomes pretty dubious. For instance, when we pressure tested Liberty Civil Defense, it came out with, 45,000 PSI of pressure. Now, Civil Defense is labeled as plus P. 45,000 PSI is way, way into the plus P plus region. I would say that's even potentially dangerous and absolutely not a plus P load as a claim. Further, as we've developed our own Dagny Dagger, which is 50 grains and 9mm, we're currently at, and we haven't even finished optimizing the dagger yet. We still have to play around with the powder load some more to get better performance. Still, our projectile is about 100, about 100 FPS faster out of the same barrel than Civil Defense is, despite being only 42,000 PSI. So we're significantly lower pressure, significantly higher velocity. So how could this be? Well, I don't think, I do think that it's quite obvious that Civil Defense, or at least Liberty Ammunition, the company that makes it, must have called up Hodgdon the way I did, got the same textbook answer, start with, 9.1 grains Winchester auto comp, and that's what they took to market. And during this entire process, did nobody bother to test that to make sure it was a safe pressure to spec? Nobody bothered to play around with it, to optimize it for the best performance. They just took the textbook responses, and that's it. They couldn't be bothered to make it as good as it should have been. And this is good ammunition. 2 years ago, I would have told you it's the best on the market. But still, nobody cared, and it shows.
So, first of all, when you say like that, you think that PSI is dangerous. What are you saying could happen? Like, are you talking about like deforming the barrel or?
Yeah, essentially there are, and admittedly, modern guns. You know, anything with a plastic frame essentially is gonna take Civil Defense just fine. You're not in danger of that. But there are older guns that can take a plus P load, which for 9mm means 38,500 PSI. It can take that just fine, safely. But if you stick something that's 45 KSI of pressure in there, then you do run the risk of deforming your barrel, the gun exploding, and, you know, generally unsavory things.
Okay. And then you kind of talked about you don't feel like they really one, verified, but then two, like really dialed in to optimize the performance. Why do you think that happens? And I know that you and I have kind of talked about like that's kind of feels that way in a number of things in like the gun and ammunition industry. Like, why is that way?
The application, like, it's not just Civil Defense. It's not just Liberty Ammunition that does this. This is like indicative of the gun industry as a whole. And I think as we go forward, like you and I have also talked about, I mean, this kind of, as we talk about the motivators and the modes of operation like this, these can be seen just about anywhere where the following dynamics apply, very many industries. So I think essentially what's going on is that the gun industry is primarily composed or driven by monster corporations that do nearly all of their business with the government. The entire industry is driven by government contracts and kind of the scramble to absorb the massive government waste that's stolen from the rest of us in taxes and dumped into the weapons industry. And famously, as we all know, anything the government touches performs terribly, is awfully inefficient, is a waste of money, is often, you know, counterproductive or counter to progress. You know, these massive companies, they make such a tiny part of their revenue selling to the commercial market. They don't have to care about it. They don't have to care about their civilian market customers. Everything for them is the government. And this also, of course, ties into why the NRA is constantly compromising our gun rights away, because the NRA fundamentally is just a corporate lobby for these massive corporations that do most of their business with the government. They don't care about selling us machine guns or bolt action rifles. They don't care about selling us AP ammo or hollow points, as long as we provide them revenue of some sort. So, you know, they oppose gun laws that would limit the number of guns bought. They don't oppose gun laws that limit the technology that we have access to. And then furthermore, the government is still putting money into weapons. Why is it then that everything is, you know, simply adequate instead of kind of excelling and progressing? Well, to be quite honest, the government treats men as disposable. They treat soldiers. They essentially assign a dollar value to the humans that fight their wars for them, and the weaponry that they supply them with is no different. They treat it just as disposably, and for them, it's just a game of cost value trade-offs. They're not looking for the next best technology. They're looking for something that just kind of meets demand, that they can put into the hands of a grunt who's going to die fighting for them. Something that can be operated by the, 80 to 100 IQ region, which is quite a lot of course, of the infantry, or at least people who enlist in the armed forces. And this is true not just in the United States, but of course, in the world at large. As these companies like develop these weapons, they're run by exactly what you would imagine, right? Officials who kind of they work for the government, they work for these corporations. It's really difficult to tell the difference between where these companies end and the federal government begins, and vice versa. And essentially, they're just trying to check off the boxes, deliver a product that meets minimum expectations, and they don't care about making the best weapon they can make. They don't care about servicing the individual who is wielding that weapon, only the nation state that is telling that individual to fight and die.
Yeah. As my grandfather used to say, they make something that's good enough for government work.
There you go. I mean, look, I've been long-winded, but I think that sums it up perfectly.
So, and this is why we see, it was really funny in your talk, just pointing out how all the gun magazines and stuff try and hype up all this, each year, the newest thing. And it's like, really, it's all aesthetics that have changed, because basically the majority of guns are some variation of an AR-15, an AK-47. Pretty much every pistol is either a 1911 or a Glock variant.
Yes.
So there has been almost no innovation since, Vietnam, maybe?
I think Gaston Glock inventing the Glock, I think that was pretty big. And there are
When was that? I guess that was 80s, right?
Yeah. And there's some newfangled cases called NAS3 on the market that I really, really believe in. I'm kind of a super fan of. I think they're very admirable as well. But yeah, I think that's about it. I would like to add, though, that ironically enough, as it's called the Dagger, the Palmetto State Armory Glock knockoff is the big thing in the gun world right now. Again, it is like a tit for tat copy of a Glock 19. Not even just a reimagined one. No, it is a clone.
It's not like a Springfield XD, which is like, here we have a polymer lower with a free floating barrel and a metal slide. It's like, this thing takes Glock mags.
Yes, yes. And Glock parts, so I hear. I mean, it's parts compatible too. And it is cheap. And I'm glad that happens. I'm glad to see, you know, the same technology get cheaper going from, I mean, hell, it only took from like the mid-1980s to now to make a cheaper version of it. But I mean, I'm glad to see that happening. But I mean, this is what's being hyped right now. This is what everybody's excited for, is just a cheap knockoff of something that happened in the 80s. So, and you know how, and I am, it sticks in my craw that they call it the dagger also.
Okay, well, while we're talking about that, then why don't you kind of go into the, if people are unfamiliar with the naming conventions for Atlas Arms and the Dagny Dagger.
Yeah. So in the 1950s, published in the 1950s, a very controversial, cold-hearted woman named Ayn Rand wrote a book called Atlas Shrugged. The book was published in the 50s. She wrote it in the 40s, I suppose. It's become a classic novel, despite its kind of controversial nature, because it is very outspoken as to Ayn Rand's philosophy, which she called objectivism. Now, I'm no objectivist. I think Ayn Rand would look quite disfavorably on some of the things we're doing with the Dagny Dagger and kind of the methods that we use, but I don't care. I'm very much inspired by the book, which is all about kind of the dignity of the individual creation, and the power of innovation and market demand for that innovation over the petty legislation and tiltings of the contrived governance of those who would pretend to rule over us. Essentially, the story of the book is that the United States government looks very much the way that it looks kind of now under the threat of Bernie Sanders and AOC et al. And all of the innovators, all of the people of industry, the people that are called, the Atlases, who bear the world on their shoulders and kind of make the engine of the world turn, the engine of civilization, they decide to go on strike. And they decide they're going to withdraw from the world at large. And if the world at large doesn't appreciate them, then they will leave. And they won't have the advantage of the enterprise that they run. From this comes Atlas Arms, from Atlas Shrugged. And of course, the main heroine of the novel is Dagny Taggart, who is an engineer and runs a railroad company. So there you go.
Very cool. And I'm familiar with the basic story, but I confess I haven't read it. You know, these kind of things in the Galt's Gulch and stuff is similar vein to the meme in the Bitcoin world of the Citadels. Although, I have to confess, I am on the fence about the whole Citadel idea. I think I get the desire to withdraw from the crazy political landscape that we find ourselves in, but I think any walls that, any wall can both be to keep things out and to keep things in. And so it could easily slip over into, from a refuge from the outside world into a prison. So I'm not sure I'm 100% sold on the Citadel's idea.
Yeah. I like the idea of withdrawal is, I think it's very valid to a point. But in addition to being inspired by Atlas Shrugged, I am also, a very convicted Christian, which of course Ayn Rand would condemn me for. But I take very much to heart the passage, be in the world and not of the world. And yeah. I think there's a lot of wisdom to that, of course, as if the word wouldn't hold wisdom to people who believe it. I think there's something almost pathological about the kind of hermitish idea of escape. And I'm pretty, I'm pretty turned on by the idea of like seasteading and that kind of thing, but I don't view that as kind of a withdrawal from the world in general.
So in your mind, how would seasteading go then?
I mean, I don't know. I'm not really sure. I guess like part of like the heart of my ideological being, and this really, you know, connects to the whole preservation of the wilderness also, is that I am kind of like radically opposed to the sort of intellectual arrogance of people that would say, oh, this is how it's going to work, which is how I kind of came to my anti-state politics as well. Everybody's saying, well, we got to have politics like this. We got to make the government function like this. This is the right policy. This is the wrong policy. I don't know. The most I can say, you know, is like I believe in kind of natural emergent systems of order. And, you know, I have policy that I favor also, but I don't pretend to know how seasteading would work. I think that if it's what I would like to see, then I think it would just kind of develop naturally, organically. I don't think there would be a plan for it necessarily.
Gotcha. Let's talk for a second on the dagger on the patent side, because you made a comment earlier about intellectual property that made me think that you're not a fan or you don't believe in intellectual property. But my understanding is you are also working to patent the design of the dagger. So kind of explain that.
Yeah, I guess maybe to frame this a little bit in my personal experience, I would tend to call myself an anarchist now. I don't think that that actually means a lot functionally. But I think if you talk to people of an anti-state perspective, you kind of always get some origin story about like when, like how was it that you made the leap from like, oh no, we want a government, but we want to keep it really, really small, to saying, you know what, I think I'm done with this idea of the state. And for me, that last connection, I always thought, okay, well, like, you know, all the functions of government could be privatized, but there's still one thing that I think we need a state for that maintains a monopoly on violence and is the highest authority, and that was intellectual property. I thought, you know, we have to have intellectual property. People have to be able to guarantee a living or ownership, some kind of propriety to make a living on their creative endeavors. And then I founded my first company, Atlas Arms, and we wrote a patent for that. I personally wrote a large part of that patent. And in the process of that, I realized that patents and intellectual property are entirely arbitrary. The system is complete garbage. There's no way to make it work. And that was it. That snapped the rubber band for me, and I just said, "To hell with the whole system." So yeah, I don't believe in intellectual property, but it is something that I know a great deal about, at least how intellectual property regulation works, and I'm familiar with the patent system. So even though the Dagny Dagger is an open source project, and, you know, we're going to be telling everybody about it. I don't believe in intellectual property. We don't want to hold anything as a monopoly. We're still publishing a patent. And there are several reasons for that. Some I would refrain from discussing quite yet for legal reasons. But the biggest one is that the federal government, as a matter of course, publishes all patent applications. So in our patent application, we told people, this is how you make this thing, and the federal government will publish it as a matter of course. This is part of our grand legal strategy because, of course, states like New Jersey prosecute people. They, you know, they say that they hold that it is illegal to publish information about guns on the internet, and they have taken legal action against people who have. So all I have to say is good luck, New Jersey, fighting the United States Patent and Trade Office, who is going to publish the Dagny Dagger for us.
Very nice. So this kind of goes along with your idea of using the state against the state.
Yes. Yes, exactly. There are a few other ways we're doing that, but I think the patent's the one that's most exciting, or at least I'm kind of the proudest of devising.
Yeah, that's clever. It's something I wouldn't have thought of. Obviously, like, you have experience working within that intellectual property realm, so you understand that. But I applaud you on that because it's one, it's just clever, so I appreciate it. And I wouldn't have had the knowledge to think of that. So let's kind of talk about, because this is a Bitcoin show, and so I probably should talk about Bitcoin at some point. But that kind of plays into, I know, somewhat of the funding for this. So talk to me about how you've raised funding for this project, how the hurdles maybe that you've had to address, and then how much does crowdfunding play into something like this?
Yeah. So to fund this project, we first went to a crowdfunding site called gundynamics.com. And that's where our main crowdfunding presence is. And by and large, the vast quantity of funds we've raised have been from there or through there, I guess I should say. But this is a site run by, as I think a lot of people in our culture would call them, boomer FUDs. They kind of wanted to take Bitcoin, but decided it wasn't worth their trouble. I got to say, they've stuck it out for us in some great ways. I'm really glad that they're there for us, because we'd get kicked off of Indiegogo and Kickstarter and, you know, everything like that. And they're made just for gun stuff. They've been great to us. They're hosting our campaign for absolutely free. I really feel a goodwill to them. And I know that they've stuck out some things that they weren't even comfortable with the controversial nature of our product, because of their principles, because they believe in this open access. So shout out to them. They've been good to us. But of course, we have to take Bitcoin. our project being in guns, and like you said, the connection between kind of subversive gun stuff, subversive Bitcoin stuff, it's a very strong bridge. And so we worked out a deal with them to take Bitcoin on our own. And as I mentioned in the beginning, first, even though we had Samurai Wallet, we just stuck up a static receive address and QR code on our website, and you helped us get a paynim, which is great. And only recently were we able to figure out BTC Pay to make it much more easier, much more secure to receive Bitcoin. And we've gotten quite a lot of donations that way. And I should say, there's a lot of people, a lot of people contact us and say, hey, I saw your crowdfunding page, but is there a way I can donate Bitcoin? Or I don't want to give my credit card information to a third party. Not only do we have a lot of that going on to get Bitcoin donations, but, you know, Bitcoiners are famously finicky. I mean, everybody's got their own thing that they want to use, whether it's like, oh, no, I don't use Bitcoin, I'm into Monero or Ethereum or, whatever else they want to use. You know how people are particular like that. But even what is that?
Oh, I was agreeing with you. Yes.
Oh, yeah. But even in like the method, like there are people said, oh, I'm not going to donate to a static address. I'm not going to use Paynim. I will only use BTC Pay, or I will only use a Paynim. So, you know, that there is a very real kind of prominent privacy-centric, privacy-concerned individual out there that's very interested in what we're doing. And it's been a really great thing that we could connect via Bitcoin and all these different methods to satisfy their desires for privacy, their particularities. And I think that I'm pretty sure right now we've received about, I don't want to say exactly, but between like $3,000 and $6,000 that we wouldn't have otherwise through Bitcoin.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And I guess, I mean, the reality is though with Bitcoin and you know, with the launch of this trailer and getting this information out there, and with the idea that you guys are going to open source the ability to, I guess we could touch on that, but I was going to say with the ability to manufacture these in various ways at home or whatever, or at least just have that knowledge to manufacture them, then, the donations through Bitcoin don't necessarily have to be from within the U.S.
Yeah, that's true. I'm not sure if we've gotten foreign donations. I know that I've been emailed by people in like South Africa who are really interested. But you know, being Bitcoin, I have no idea where they are. Nor do I need to know. So,
right.
It would be interesting to know though. And if people wanted to donate from overseas, it would be just as easy. So yeah, I should say something else though. Speaking of kind of artificial state borders, about Bitcoin. So I lived in Tennessee when we first incorporated Atlas Arms as a 501c3 corporation. Then we moved. We moved to Arizona. I had to move to Arizona, but we had to leave our incorporation status in Tennessee because Tennessee makes it very, very difficult to move a corporation out of the state. We would have had to reincorporate totally, and then we would have had to reapply for our IRS nonprofit status. Well, at this point, having the reputation that we do, I was really scared that they weren't going to grant us our 501c3 status back. So we had to leave all of that in Tennessee. Well, Arizona won't allow us to have a bank account in the state of Arizona if we're not incorporated here. So we had to leave our bank account back in the custody of a good friend of ours in Tennessee to care for our bank account. So our bank account's in Tennessee. We don't even have banking in Arizona where we live and work. That has been an enormous problem. So we can order stuff online. That's easy. But we can't even, we can't maintain the checkbook. We can't write checks here. We can't just go to brick and mortar stores to buy supplies that we need, like gunpowder or reloading supplies, stuff like that. But Bitcoin allows us to be very, very agile. We can always do. I mean, Bitcoin's universal. The state's not going to shut us down. It can cross, interstate barriers, let alone international barriers. We prefer Bitcoin donations, if nothing else, that it makes it much easier for us to do business.
Very cool. I love hearing those stories of Bitcoin in use. And I know that there are people who are like, who will say holding and saving is using, and that's true and that's fine. But, I love the censorship resistant nature of Bitcoin and being put to those kind of uses that solve right now problems.
Yeah. And the people always think, well, you can't do anything with Bitcoin. Well, that's true. You can't go to the gas station and buy a Coke with it. And there's still a lot of people out there think, oh, Bitcoin is just for buying drugs. But like we've purchased a considerable value in industrial adhesive dispensing supplies with Bitcoin. It's incredible the number of industries that take it and what you can actually buy with it. And yeah, it's funny, when we bought those dispensing supplies with Bitcoin, the transaction was, the order was processed and the transaction was verified in like half an hour. We ordered something from Grainger, who is this massive, very, very well-known industrial supplier, an hour before that, and it took like a few days before the order was confirmed and payment was fully through the system. So it's incredible.
Fantastic. Yeah. All right. So, I think that probably covers it. We're coming up on the hour mark here. What, and like I said, I will, I already posted it on my personal Twitter, but, what am I trying to say? I will put a link to the trailer that you just launched because it's awesome to watch.
Thanks.
And, what kind of are you working on going forward? What kind of time frame are you thinking to get to, what you're calling your final form?
Yeah, I think as far as development of the cartridge itself, we'll be done in several months. Now, it's kind of difficult because of where we are in northern Arizona and with the equipment and facilities we have, or the lack thereof. A lot of our timetable, unfortunately, in the winter is decided by the weather. Whether it snows, whether it's, too cold. If it's like, if for instance, this is below freezing and one of our shots fails, if it the bullet explodes as it leaves a barrel or something, we don't know if that's because of very, very cold temperatures or because the design change we made failed. So it depends a lot on the weather, but the very rare alloy that we're working with, that brings its own logistical challenges. So it depends, but I would say the next several months, I think there's a possibility that we can have it finished by the end of the year, but probably we're looking at, March, April, maybe February of 2021. For that. But then, of course, that's just the cartridge itself. It's really, really hard to tell when other stuff will be out. Then, the challenge becomes, the methods to mass produce the dagger, to commercialize it, developing the tools, software, and methods for people to DIY this at home. And then, of course, to commercialize more to that, that we have to do all the logistical legwork of figuring out, machine shops to make the parts for us, how we're going to put it all together. We've got to get, production investment in the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars. So, that's going to take a while. I think we're looking at a year or more, probably more than a year, to get to the commercialized form. But honestly, it all has a lot to do with the donations we receive, kind of the investment interest. We're just going to have to see. We're a small enterprise. We're a nonprofit. And that means that we make more innovative stuff than the industry that's driven by investment and government contracts. But it also means that we move at a slower, more uncertain pace.
Gotcha. Okay, so... how can people keep up with, your information and, advances as it comes out?
So check out our website, alicearms.org. We actually just, around this video and kind of this relaunch, we kind of reformatted the website. Well, not reformat exactly. We added some things to it. I think if you go and check out, there are some new projects and features there. And that's a good way in general to get accustomed to the company and the project. Also check out our Twitter. Of course, you know, that's the day-to-day stuff, the little tidbits you don't hear on the website. We've got a YouTube channel with some other videos on it, and we'll be posting more there in the coming months. I think that's about it. Anyone is always free to email the company at dagny@atlasarms.org or me personally, austin@atlasarms.org.
Very cool. And so people can donate in Bitcoin. I see you got the BTC pay up and the Paynim up on here. Looks good. Yes. I hadn't checked it since we had talked about that. So it looks good. If they want to, because you're a 501c3, that's a tax deductible donation, right? If they pay
that's fiat. Right. So yeah. Well, no. I mean, look, if you pay in Bitcoin, I mean that still has a dollar value. It still has a fair dollar value, and we can write you a donation receipt for that also. Of course, you would have to email us or, you know, contact us somehow to tell us about that and to confirm it. But you can donate Bitcoin, and we can give you a tax deduction receipt.
Very cool. So tax deductible either way. Does that fall under like using the state against the state?
I think it does. Personally, I think it does. You know, there are lots of 501c3 companies out there, but of course, clearly, the federal government did not foresee or did not purpose that tax code to be used in such a manner as we are.
Yeah. So cool. So, what are there other ways that people can help?
Yeah, like, I mean, obviously, our most pressing need is dollars, or, you know, look, money, whatever funding form it's in. So, you know, that's enormous. And really, like, that helps more than anything. But of course, there's always, you know, spreading the word. Even if you can't afford to donate, we understand completely. Tell other people about us. Get us a higher profile. That will help, not just in other people donating, but also in kind of raising our reputation, making it easier for us to maneuver within this very exclusive firearms industry. And then the last thing is, if you happen to be a skilled professional, somebody that has a skill relevant to our project, something that might be useful, email me. We're always, you know, we're always looking for people to help. We can't pay you. We're a nonprofit firm. We still need more money than we have in the bank. But, you know, we're always looking for volunteers, and that can be a very powerful thing. Specifically, we can always use electrical engineers. That's a big one, electrical. I'm a great engineer, and I had this company. I don't have bandwidth for all the stuff we do, but I'm not great with electronics. If you're an electrical engineer, please reach out. Mechanical engineers, technical people, scientists in general, we need people that even somebody that wants to manage our social media accounts, do other kinds of outreach for us. You know, whatever your skill set is, if you think it might be useful, drop us a line.
Would they have to come to Arizona for that, or could some of that be done remotely?
I mean, it'd be great if you could come to Arizona. We have an intern that kind of came for the summer and stayed indefinitely. And I'll extend the same offer out there. If you're jazzed about this and you want to make it your life and live as a monk in my attic, eating my food and working on Atlas Arms all day, I'll talk about it. I'm open to it. But most of the people that contribute to this project live other places. So, yeah, we're completely open. I mean, Very cool. these are the days of COVID. Nobody works at the office anymore, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Austin. Well, I appreciate your time. This was fun. Maybe we can do it again sometime when you reach another milestone.
Yeah, great. I look forward to it. And again, thank you for the help that you've offered us in terms of Bitcoin accessibility. And thank you for the opportunity to talk on your show.
Absolutely. All right, man. Take care.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Okay, that's going to do it for today's show. I hope you guys enjoyed that. I know I did. This is the kind of thing that really gets me psyched. I love seeing projects that aren't just another Bitcoin wallet app with some new feature or something like that. I mean, those are cool, but I love seeing real, tangible, like real world things that give power back to the everyday person that are made possible by Bitcoin, right? Like, this is the censorship resistant nature of Bitcoin and those kind of like using spending Bitcoin, right? Properties that make this kind of project possible. And certainly they had funding, like they said, from Gun Dynamics through Fiat, but it is definitely different in the things that he talked about with their incorporation through various states and all that. So and just the headache that they're able to bypass with Bitcoin and the ability to continue to be agile because of Bitcoin. And that's the stuff I love. So anyway, you guys go follow Atlas Arms on Twitter. I think it's Atlas_Arms_org. Their website is atlasarms.org. I'll leave links in the show notes to all of that and to the trailer where Austin shows off the effectiveness against soft body armor of the Dagny Dagger, which is really cool to see. So you guys go check that stuff out. As always, follow me on Twitter at BottomShelfBTC, and you can go to bottomshelfbitcoin.com/kidsbook if you want to purchase Tuttle Twins books. That's a great way to learn about these ideas of liberty and free market economics and all of these things. Whether you're an adult or a kid, they just put it in really fun little stories that are digestible. And it doesn't change the price either way, but it gives a little kickback to me for doing that. So check that out and subscribe so you don't miss the next episode, and share this one with all of your friends and maybe your enemies too. I don't care. Whatever. Get the signal out there. All right. For Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.